There we are. Okay, so we're here in lecture four, and I want to just continue with our journey through chapter three, which is by far the longest, and it's on test of the Schwarzschild metric. So what we're up to today is, having just completed the section on the advance of pericenter of the orbit, then what we're going to do next, oops, if I plug in my laptop of course, what we're going to do next is we're going to talk about gravitational lensing. So this is a very trendy topic in astrophysics, and it's been one of the most powerful new techniques to come along since I was a student to help us understand lots of things, everything from dark matter to measuring the Hubble constant. It's quite an old, insofar as obviously GR is quite new compared with many areas of physics, but it's an old aspect of GR in that it was thought about right in the very early days by Einstein, but it's only in the relatively recent past that it's become possible to use gravitational lensing to do, well, some of the cool things that we're going to talk about today. So let me try to persuade the computer screen to show you something. Yeah, there we are. Well, there it was. No, that's it. Got it back. So, before we start section 3.4, is there any questions about previous stuff that you want to ask about? Okay. Let's get going then. So, initially, the maths of this section will bear a very strong similarity to what we covered in the previous section. But just before we get going in the maths, let me say a little bit about the words of the, you know, sort of underlying physics. Light deflection was one of the classic tests of GRG. Indeed, it really follows immediately from the equivalence principles. And in astronomy 2, when we have a course in relativity and gravitation, we just applied the strong equivalence principle to a falling lift and established that as a result, you've got to have light deflection in order that the view of the laws of physics inside the lift and outside the lift are consistent with each other. But in this section we're going to derive basically the same result, but do it a bit more rigorously. It's not quite the same result. Einstein was already halfway there towards the result that we're going to see today, in about, oh, I think it was about 1914 or 1915, but it took him a bit longer to get the full-blown result that we're going to see today. Initially, what he thought was the case was that the GR prediction would be that light was deflected, and in fact it would agree with the Newtonian prediction. But what it later transpired was that there was a factor of two difference, and a factor of two difference is, you know, that's quite easy to measure in physics problems. So the person that got the job of going off to measure it was Arthur Eddington. There were numerous experiments conducted, but this is perhaps the most famous one. It was done in 1919, and many of you might have seen the TV programme about it quite recently, in which David Tennant was Arthur Eddington and Andy Serkis was Albert Einstein. But anyway, what I just said a minute ago might have got your ears pricked up, because I said, well, Einstein's original calculation agreed with the prediction of Newtonian gravity. Well, you know, according to Newtonian gravity, would we expect to get light deflection at all? Well, the answer is kind of yes and no, because we now know that light consists, or can be thought of at least, as photons, and that those photons are massless. And according to Newtonian gravity, if a particle is massless, then it won't feel any Newtonian force at all. So massless photons ought not to be deflected by the gravitational field at all. But of course, Newton didn't know that light consisted of massless photons. And Newton was quite keen on the, what's the phrase people think, say, the corpuscular theory of light, the idea that it was indeed made up of little packets. And I guess he supposed that they had mass, and therefore would be affected by the gravitational force. And in fact, in 1801, a calculation was done within the Newtonian framework by a German mathematician called Soldner, which established that if light consisted of massive particles, presumably with very small mass, moving fast, then light would be deflected. So that's the calculation that we can regard as the kind of Newtonian light deflection result, and that's what we'll compare with the GR calculation. Okay? So Newtonian light deflection. Well, in the previous section, and I've now put up on Moodle some slides to, they're not on the Moodle site directly, they're just on my GR site so that everyone can access them whether they're signed up for the Astro Honours Moodle or not. So the GR2, just to remind you, you get at that from my teaching homepage, for example, or there's a link on Moodle and you'll be prompted for a username and password. Those are both honours. And what you'll see on there now is just a few slides from the last lecture, which were some of the pictures, you might as well have those if you want, but also there was the diagram of an ellipse, just reminding you what the different constituent parts of the ellipse was, the focal points, the eccentricity, the semilatus rectum, and so on. So, when we're talking about light deflection, we're not going to be thinking of ellipses, we're going to be thinking of hyperbola, or hyperbolae, because in Newtonian dynamics, if we do think of light as possessing mass, then you'd expect that light moving very fast will not actually be captured by a massive body, but instead will follow a hyperbolic trajectory as it passes by a massive body. And the description of that will take the form of equation 336. So E is the eccentricity, which is bigger than 1 for a hyperbola. R min is the distance of the light particle, which, for want of a better word, we'll call a photon, even though, as I said, we know that photons are massless according to modern physics. We're thinking of them as having some unspecified but non-zero mass for this calculation. R min is the minimum distance of the photon from the point mass M, that's like our star that we're thinking of as the source of the light deflection. So figure 3 shows that trajectory. Let me just find that there. So you've got your own copy, I guess. I'll just point out a few of the salient features. So there's the R min, the minimum distance between the mass M and the massive light particle, and we've essentially got a hyperbolic trajectory, which is different from what would be the straight line trajectory if there was no light deflection. So our job is to work out what the deflection angle is. Deflection angle delta phi, which we can conveniently in this diagram divide up into two pieces. We've got delta phi over 2 at this end, and by symmetry, we're going to have delta phi over 2 at the other end as well. Okay? So what is delta phi? How do we work it out? So equation 337 is the first step towards that. It's just essentially the equation that tells you what phi is at either end of the hyperbolic trajectory. So it's plus or minus pi over 2 plus delta phi over 2. Okay? If there was no light deflection at all, then the trajectory would just go from phi equals minus pi by 2 to phi equals pi by 2. So we can get a long way in solving this just by doing the same as we did in the previous section and looking at the Newtonian solution. Excuse me. So let's see how that gets us. So the motion of our Newtonian photon, our massive light particle, is going to satisfy the differential equation r squared d phi by dt equals h. For those who've done several years of astronomy, as I remarked in the last section, you'll recognise that as essentially Kepler's second law. And h, as we saw in the previous section, is the same thing. Here, it is related to the semilatus rectum of the hyperbola, but now the expression for that is just slightly different, and it takes the form of 339. And what we'll also do to make further progress is we'll use an energy equation. So the photon is going to satisfy that. Essentially, all we've got here is, remembering that G equals 1, is the sum of the kinetic energy per unit mass for our massive light particles, and the potential energy per unit mass. So that's all got to add up to a constant, the total energy. And then in the intermediate step, we've just replaced V squared by an expression involving the radial component and the transverse component. So it's dr by dt squared plus r squared d phi by dt squared. You can actually derive that expression there in terms of all the tensor transformations and vector transformations that Norman worked on in the first semester, but you've maybe seen this sort of relation before anyway. It's just where you express v as a sort of v radial and v perpendicular components, so each of those squared, and this is the form they take. You've got the r squared d phi by dt squared. So in other words, you're turning, you know, vx squared plus vy squared, if it was just Cartesian components, into vr squared and v phi squared. And that's the form they take. That's pretty much just what I've said at the bottom, the squared radial and squared transverse velocity components. Okay? Now, where does that get us? Well, without too much extra work, we can turn an equation into what we want, which is an equation involving r and phi. So dr by dt, we can write that as dr by d phi, d phi by dt. And then doing a little bit of substitution, you get equation 342. And then from equation 336, some further substitution, you get 343. So there's a fair bit of algebra for you to check over for yourself and make sure that you can see how each step gets to the next step. And then the magic phrase, after a little algebra, it's really not much, just a couple of lines, you get that this expression that the total energy is the mass of the deflector times E minus 1. Remember, it's a hyperbola, so E is bigger than 1, divided by 2 times the minimum distance arm in. And what you see then is that as R tends to infinity, if we quickly look back to equation 336, then that requires us to have cos phi equal to minus 1 over E. Remember, E is bigger than 1, so minus 1 over E is going to be less than 1. So that will give us the denominator of this expression going to 0, so R goes to infinity. So in other words, those are the asymptotic limits where the photon is very far from the deflector. And the reason we introduce that is that, well, Eto is a constant. This is just Newtonian physics we're using here, so we're just assuming that the total energy is a constant. Therefore, we can work out the total energy, which is a constant, by working out what it is when you're far away from the deflector, i.e. setting R equal to infinity. Okay? And if we set V equals C equal 1 in equation 340, in other words, just assuming that the light particle is moving at the speed of light, which is no great surprise, then what that winds up giving you is that E tot is equal to a half. Okay, so you can check over for yourself that you can see. Excuse me. I've been carrying a dreadful cough for the last several days, so I'll be doing a fair bit of coughing and spluttering, I'm afraid. Hopefully I'm not too infectious, but you're a safe distance away from me anyway. I'll try not to cough in your direction. So anyway, rearranging 344, the one you can just see up there, having worked out that E tot is a half, then that gives us that E, the eccentricity of the hyperbola, is 1 plus R min over M, where we also basically say that that's just approximately R min over M. That's taking the assumption that the mass of the deflector in units of length, you know, the trick that we do of replacing masses by lengths, is much smaller than the minimum deflection angle, minimum deflection distance. Let me justify that, say, for the case of the sun, because the mass of the sun in units of length is 1.5 kilometres. Whereas if you're looking at a light ray that's being bent just at the edge of the sun, then R min is the radius of the sun, which is much, much bigger than 1.5 kilometres. So R min over M is vastly bigger than 1. Okay? Which is, in other words, is saying that the hyperbola has got an eccentricity that's a lot bigger than 1. So we can crank through some more algebra. Cos phi, remember, for the outgoing direction of the photon, phi is pi by 2 plus delta phi over 2. And cos of that is equal to minus sine of delta phi over 2, but we figure that delta phi is small. Delta phi is very much less than 1, so that gives us minus delta phi over 2 is equal to minus m over r min, or delta phi is equal to 2m over r min. So just as we argued that r min over m was very large, so that of course means that m over r min is very small. So the deflection angle is going to be small. So the situation I was talking about, where a light ray is deflected close to the limb of the sun, is what's represented in cartoon form in figure 4. Here's us at the Earth, and there's some background star which is really in the left position there, but it looks as if it's in the right hand position there because the light ray is following this hyperbolic path and it appears as if it's coming from the position on the right. That is what we now refer to as gravitational lensing, gravitational light deflection. Okay, now, I'll talk about how this was observed by Arthur Eddington. Again, most of you probably know the story anyway. But before we do that, let's see what he was trying to compare with. So we've got this Newtonian result. If we rather incorrectly think of light as having a mass, then the deflection angle should be 2 times m over r min. Let's see what we get if we work it out in GR. So to do it in GR, we just work with the geodesic differential equations, but we don't use the geodesic in terms of proper time because the photons essentially moving at the speed of light in their rest frame, the interval is always zero. So it doesn't really make sense to talk in terms of the proper time. Time would stop if you could run alongside a photon, although in order to do it you'd have to be massless. So what we do is we introduce a new parameter. The technical mathematical term is an affine parameter. Call it lambda say, which is the argument of our geodesic differential equation. You might well ask, well, what is lambda? In a way it doesn't really matter, because what we're going to do is to measure the length along the geodesic in terms of angles, and in fact that would be a perfectly good affine parameter to use. So we're going to wind up with an expression for how r changes as a function of phi. So the way we do that is by very close analogy with what we did in the previous section. That first of all, we notice that dt by d lambda and d phi by d lambda are both of the form given by 349, 350. How we get that is to do with exactly the same condition that we used in the previous section, that the relevant term in the metric doesn't depend on t or phi, therefore the right hand side term in the geodesic differential equation has to be zero, and that right hand side term is dt by d lambda times gtt, that when you differentiate it has to be zero, therefore it's a constant, and then you take the gtt down and you get 1 minus 2m over r on the denominator. And the same sort of reasoning gets you 350. Just as we saw in the last chapter as well, we've got this particular solution where theta is pi by 2. Okay? And that means that d theta by d lambda is 0, because theta is just a constant. And then we can determine from equation 130, which is just this convenient different way to represent the differential, geodesic differential equation, we get an equation for dr by d lambda. But remember, our ultimate goal is to replace lambda, this unknown affine parameter, which we know can't be the proper time because that doesn't make sense for a photon. But whatever it is, it's a way of measuring how far along the geodesic the photon has travelled, so a convenient way to represent lambda is by an angle phi, so that's what we do. We replace lambda by phi, and what that does is it gives us the differential equation d2u by d phi squared plus u equals 3mu squared. Well, that's pretty similar to what we did in the previous section. And once again, how we proceed is by using the Newtonian solution as an approximation to the GR solution and just add on a correction term to give us the GR solution. So if the right hand side was zero, then a particular integral of this differential equation would be very simple in form. It would be that u is cos phi over r min. Okay, I'm just giving you the answer, but what you can see by substituting that back into equation 353 is that d2u by d phi squared plus u would indeed equal zero. Okay, so you can verify that for yourself. So what we're going to do to get the GR solution is that we're going to take the Newtonian solution and put it into the right-hand side of the GR differential equation and then see if we can solve that one. So what we get is d2u by d phi squared plus u, so that's the left-hand side of the GR equation, and the right-hand side was equal to 3u, so what we now do is just replace that by 3mu rather, and replace that by 3m times cos over r min, cos phi over r min, all squared, which we can in turn rewrite as the final bit of 355, replacing cos squared phi by a half, 1 plus cos 2 phi. And then once again, to save you the trouble of having to search around and find a solution to that equation, it's a lot easier if I just tell you what the answer is and you can verify for yourself that it does indeed satisfy the differential equation. So a particular integral takes the form of 356. So the general solution is the solution to the homogeneous equation, that's a Newtonian one, where the right hand side is zero, the cos phi over r min, plus the particular integral that solves the general equation. Okay, so that's the 3m over 2r squared min, 1 minus a third cos 2 phi. Okay, so we're almost there. What we've got to do next is to write, using equation 337, what the relevant expression would be for the outgoing photon. So let's just have a look back at what 337 was. It all starts to get a bit blurry as to how they all connect together. But the outgoing photon is phi equals minus pi by 2 minus delta phi by 2. Okay. And our general solution is the form of 357. So if we put in phi equals, well actually I've put in the positive solution, it doesn't really matter, because cos of x is the same as cos of minus x anyway. So it's cos pi by 2 plus delta phi by 2 over r min plus 3m over 2 r squared min minus 1 minus a third cos. So if phi is equal to pi by 2 plus delta phi over 2, then 2 phi is pi plus delta phi. So there we've got our pi plus delta phi. Or, in other words, you can write that as u equals the stuff you see in 359, where I've made use of the fact that delta phi is much less than 1, assuming a small deflection angle. And that can simplify even a bit more to give us 360. Okay? And very nearly almost there. If we set u equals 0, that corresponds to r tending to infinity because u is 1 over r. So setting u equals 0 will tell us what the behaviour of the trajectory is when you're far away from the lens. And if you put u equals 0, that's the left-hand side of 360 is 0, then that means you've got 2m over r squared min is equal to delta phi over 2r min. We arrange that, you get delta phi is 4 m over r min. Or if you explicitly put g and c back in, then you get 4 g m over c squared r min. Okay? Right. I know it's a lot of algebra, but the end result is quite remarkable, because what you find is that the GR prediction, once it's done really properly, not just the simplistic way that we first look at light deflection in the second year astronomy course where you've got a falling elevator, but actually doing it within the Schwarzschild metric, then you get that the light deflection angle is twice what it would be if you naively assumed that light had mass and it just obeyed Newton's law of gravity. So a factor of 2 should in principle be quite easy to measure. Often in physics we're faced with the experimental task of measuring tiny fractions of a percent change between one theory and another. This is a whopping big factor of 2. Shouldn't be that hard to measure. But how could you do it? Well, one way to proceed would be to observe a solar eclipse. Again, as I say, you're probably all familiar with the story that Eddington set off in 1919 to observe this solar eclipse, because that was a rare opportunity to see a star very close to the sun on the sky. Normally you wouldn't see it because the sun's too bright, but he could determine whether the light from that background star was being deflected as it passed close to the sun. Okay. So, the delta phi that you calculate, if you stick some numbers in, and you've got to be able to do this. Remember, if we measure the mass of the sun, for example, in units of length, it's 1.5 times 10 to the 3 meters. 1.5 kilometers is the mass of the sun expressed in units of length. The radius of the sun in meters is 6.95 times 10 to the 8. The factor of 4, put all that together, you get 1.77 arcseconds. An arcsecond is a 3,600th of a degree, and the sun's about half a degree across on the sky. So it's a very small effect. So although the difference between the Newtonian and the GR prediction is a factor of 2, and that's quite good because there's sort of clear water between the two theories, it still required the measurements to be made on a very small angular scale.